This is Edge Cases, a podcast about the grumpier side of software development, mostly, but not always, Apple-related. Featuring myself and my co-host, the Rocky and Bullwinkle of Objective-C, I'm Andrew Pontius.
And I'm Will French.
This is episode 48. It's Saturday, May 4th, 2013, and our topic this week is WWDC.
A topical topic.
No, I'm kidding. So yes, we're not actually a topical show, as we talked about last week. So while I would actually like to talk about WWDC, not just the current issues, like the craziness with the tickets over, 2 weeks ago now, but also its history, I think we could have some fun with that. But I've heard about it in maybe three other podcasts in the last 2 weeks, so I'm not going to inflict that on you again. Instead, something related, I'd like to talk about how we learn as developers. And so that's a very large topic. So I'm actually going to focus more. I'm going to focus on what resources we use to learn as developers. And so I will be talking about WWDC as a part of that. WWDC. It's very hard to say quickly, right? That's been mentioned by other people.
Yeah, I've long given up and have gone with the dub.
Dub. Yeah. No, that's I will.
I know you fight.
I will
this.
Resist that. Yes. Yeah, I fight it.
And my hat's off to you. I fought it for a while myself.
Okay. All right. So I'm going to start with an example, and it should be an example that is familiar to all of you who have been listening to Edge Cases, because we just went through it over the last 2 weeks, and that's my learning of auto layup. Mm-hmm. So how did I do that? Well, in this case, I got a book, right? I got the iOS Auto Layout Demystified by Erica Sadoun. We'll see how many times I can say that name properly before I erase the guilt of saying it wrong the first time around. And I did this because the book had gotten some good reviews. Also, I had followed her on Twitter long enough that I had a sense for how she could write. And her other books got good reviews and everything like that. So that's when I said, well, how can I do it? That was one of the options available to me. And so I went through the book. I read the book. I've actually finished the book now. Woo! Which is hard. I should make sure that I talk about this so that I don't have it in the notes. A lot of times I don't finish the books that I buy to read stuff. So yeah, we'll make sure we talk about that. But in this case, I did. Just because I wanted to be able to say it on the podcast. I finished. And I did put together some examples, as I talked about in the episode. But there are some things that I didn't do, which I would consider to be part of the learning process. I wouldn't consider myself to be someone who has learned auto layout yet. Because I didn't follow through and make something that I shipped with it. Mm-hmm. And I consider that to be an integral part of the process, and we'll get to that a little bit more about in a minute. And I know also I watched one of the WWDC videos from 2012. I have heard 2112, that would be a little bit of quite a ways in the future on it. And what was interesting about watching that, so I didn't watch the other ones, and so that will also be part of my full learning process about this. But what was interesting about it was that I watched the introductory video, and it was actually, I believe, entirely information that I'd already learned from the book. So you might think, well, you know, that's boring, I wouldn't want to do that. But actually it wound up feeling kind of good to do it that way, because it meant that I had, you know, a second source that was telling me that I was able to verify the information against. I was able to say, you know, I do understand this because now that I've gotten the first take of it from the book, I can now validate that against something else. So, it's, you know, it's like writing an article where you say, you know, for any one piece of information, you want to get two sources for it. Mm-hmm. And so that actually felt like it was a good part of that learning process. If I had listened to an introductory session about it, and the information was different, well, then I would know, well, I didn't really learn that as well as I thought I did. So I should go back and figure more stuff out. So now, Wolf, I know that you've done more than me with auto layout, for example. So how did you learn auto layout?
Well, I did watch the videos.
Right.
Manton was talking about this on Core Intuition. About how, like, when he learns something, he just kind of, like, looks at the headers and then kind of flails at it at first. And I'm pretty sure I think I might have, well, you know, I don't know if I even found the headers, because Autoly is kind of weird, because it's not like this huge new thing type thing that's like in its own framework or whatever. So it's like this one class and this one header file,
right.
And there's a smattering methods in other places. But so there was no, you know, if you grep the files, there's nothing about auto layout in there. It's because it's, you know, and it's layout constraint. So maybe if I kind of just did layout, I would have found it, but that would have also gotten a bunch of false hits. So I think it's, I might have actually kind of looked around for auto layout type stuff and not finding it. I might have then watched the video, but usually I do actually look at the header files first and try to look at the classes and think of, I kind of like know what the framework does, and then I look at the classes, and then I try to piece together like how I would make it this work, and then I go to the videos.
Go to the videos, and then you just go ahead and do it, right? Well, now you had specific projects that you were learning it for, yes?
Yes.
Right, so you... After you watch the videos or whatever, you just said, okay, now I'm going to go ahead and make some stuff and see how it works.
Right. For a shipping product, yeah.
Right. Right. And I would say, so again, I call that kind of learning by doing. And so let's see, why do I think this is necessary? Well, there's a couple of things about that that I think you can't get any other way. Now, I also think it kind of leads to the paradox that in order to do something well, you have to have already done it. So that kind of means it's harder, if not impossible, to do something really well the first time.
Right.
But yeah, that's programming for you. So what are the things here? The first one is like learning all the little details about it. The documentation you're going to read, the sessions you're going to listen to, they're never going to have all those details. They're always a summation of the issue rather than everything you need to know. Because if they had everything you needed to know, it would take 2 weeks to just get through the session. So I think that's necessary. I also think, number two, I think it's important that you solve the problems that come up in everyday usage. And I found this, that even if they're necessary, like if I, you know, when I look back on after wrestling with something, trying to learn something, I'll find that the problems I came up with were not necessarily problems that I needed to have trouble with. Like if I had really, you know, read the documentation completely correctly and gotten all the details right, I wouldn't have, you know, had any stumbling blocks at all. I just would have gone ahead and do it. But it's actually kind of nice to get to a point where you say, well, all right, I've got to think about this, and I've got to think about how to find the right information to fix this. I've got to work something through in my mind that I didn't quite understand correctly, so that, you know, you get that process of really, really fixing it in your mind. Okay, here's how it really works. I think that process of solving problems with it is also pretty essential to making it happen. Now, one thing I saw at Apple was that there was usually an effort to get internal clients to use the new APIs that they were writing while they were writing them, or, you know, shortly after they were writing, certainly before they shipped it. And if I remember correctly, this happened with Core Data, that there were internal clients to Core Data before they shipped. Because the trouble is, if you create a new API and release it without ever having anyone work through that process, to sort of that learning by doing, then nobody knows how to solve those everyday problems with your APIs. You know, nobody has gone through the gotchas of this design that nobody really kind of thought through. And that's a real problem, because then that, you know, that might mean that your API winds up being unusable or hard enough that it can't be used in the ways that you want it to be used. So you really want clients for stuff. And actually, I don't know if I've said this on the podcast before, you know, my thinking is, even just for writing your own APIs, I would tend to not ever try to make a general purpose API in your own source code unless you have two clients for it. And it's the same sort of thing. You're learning how to use your own API, and you can't do that if there's only one client, because you have nothing to compare it against. So, and as I just said, I think gotchas are also, they're kind of their own categories. So I would call that like the third thing involved here. That, you know, the areas where, okay, if you do step one, step two, and step three, then don't do step four. You know, here's one thing to avoid. The things to avoid as opposed to the things to actually do. And I think I've also said this possibly on the podcast, that the trouble with Apple's documentation is that they never go low level enough to explain those gotchas to you when you use the technology. They will tell you, the summation, the summary of what to do, but they never get so low level as to say, yeah, you know, we know you probably want to do this, but don't do it. And so, and a little note here for a second, we're going to get to more about WWDC in a little bit. But I think some of the WWDC sessions actually do go to that level of detail. Like there's sometimes a little bit at the end of a session which says, oh yeah, and here's the things you got to watch for. So that can be useful, and that can be one reason to like being able to watch those sessions. But I also think there are some things you don't learn by doing. And let's see if I can explain this. For example, I've seen people who learned Objective-C kind of all on their own, rather than, you know, sort of amidst the community, I guess would be one way to put it. And the people that I've seen who did this that I saw were having problems, they came from a C++ background. So the code that I saw that they wrote, it was Objective-C code, I guess, technically, but it really felt like they were still writing C++ code. So they were learning by doing, they were writing this code, but they weren't learning enough by doing to get themselves to the right spot. And if they keep going down that path of doing exactly what they're doing like that, they're never going to do it the right way. Have you seen anything like this, Wolf?
Yeah, definitely. But I would say I have more experience seeing like Java programmers kind of move to Objective-C and seeing like the kind of the Java idioms than
C++. Sure.
Yeah,
I think that quite likely to be true. So if you can't just learn everything by doing, then obviously you do need to use externally available resources aside from necessarily just books, just for the everyday stuff. So I want to go through a couple of those now and just maybe say what's interesting about those. So if you're going to search on something, what's the most likely thing that's going to search on Objective-C problems, it's keywords that you could think of, anything like that. What's the most likely thing that's going to come up, the most likely website?
I imagine Stack Overflow.
That would be Stack Overflow, right? So I consider that to be the current reigning champion. Now, I've heard some people talk about sort of Stack Overflow jumping the shark or becoming much less useful than it was before. Some people seem really disgusted with it. I don't know if you've seen that Wolf.
Yeah, rightfully so in certain circumstances, yeah.
Okay, so I haven't seen that in practice. I haven't seen things where like, oh, I'm getting a certain kind of information, but I really wish it were better or it were different or something like that. Like, what's wrong with Stack Overflow now?
I'm trying to remember the controversy there. Yeah. You know, I better just to not say anything because I'll screw it up if I try to recall it. But there definitely was a kind of like a problem with the fundamental model about how answers were accepted. I know there's kind of like a general grumbling about conversational topics versus black and white topics, and like useful questions, even if they're not black and white, whether they should be kept around. I know there's like I believe there's like also a reign of deletionist type stuff where they'll like aggressively close questions that they think aren't good questions or that they incorrectly think are duplicates of other questions.
Yeah. I mean, I'm curious about it because for me, it's still just a tremendous resource.
Oh yeah, it's definitely number one for me.
Like 9 times out of 10, if I have a problem, if I just find the right keywords, and finding them isn't usually that difficult, I could find somebody who's answered a question about it, and that helps me along my way. Maybe not giving me exactly what I need, but usually really helpful. Now, the 10th time or the 100th time that I find that no one has found that exact issue, I think there's been once or twice where I've tried to post questions, but since I'm not a heavy user of the site and I haven't answered a lot of questions myself, I think that may factor into the fact that, questions I ask are generally pretty much ignored. Mm-hmm. So you really have to find someone else who's asked the question, someone else who's gotten an answer for it in order to reap the benefit of Stack Overflow. And it is kind of on my to-do list to get more involved in it because I know people who do answer questions and that sort of thing, mm-hmm. but I just haven't gotten to it yet. And, maybe if I get involved, I would find out some of these problems. I'd find some things to complain about. But so far, I don't have that.
Well, I know I mentioned a couple episodes back that the auto layout tag is kind of, right. This Wild West. If you want to go and claim that for your own, now that you've watched all the videos and read the book, you probably could become the auto layout expert.
Well, that, I guess, I don't feel that I would be ready to do that yet because I wouldn't be able to answer, the kind of real world questions that I think people have. Although, if the answer to the real world questions most people have is don't use Interface Builder, then hey, I can answer those.
Oh, there you go.
And I've also seen that there are people who kind of answer a lot of the easy questions as a way to sort of build up, I guess, karma or whatever it is. And I'm not sure I'd want to spend a lot of time doing that. That kind of feels like kind of, you know, doing the repetitive tasks in the massively multiplayer online games.
Yeah, was that called grinding or something?
Grinding. Yeah. So not sure that's all that interesting for me. So not sure I want to get too more involved in Stack Overflow, but it's certainly a great resource. But I think one of the reasons why it is a resource these days is because of Apple's kind of implosion in their resources, developer resources. Because back in the day, the place where you asked questions about, you know, Apple developer topics, Cocoa developer topics, was Apple's mailing list. And you could get the same sort of kind of in-depth information, and you could often get it from Apple engineers there. And so sometimes you still see some answers from the mailing list show up, because they do get indexed by Google. And the nice thing about having the Apple engineers there was it was kind of like a little mini WWDC, because you could get information on gotchas and implementation details that you wouldn't be able to find any other way, and certainly you wouldn't find in Apple's documentation. And I found that tongues would be looser on the mailing list than in some ways we had any right to expect. And that always felt a little odd. Like, how does that happen?
Right.
Why do people do that? Maybe it feels less permanent, right? It feels less official. But of course, it is permanent. It's indexed by Google. For example, if you search on Andrew Pontius Xcode-users, you will find a bunch of posts from me. Although it actually isn't in Google. Apparently, other sites will scrape the Apple mailing list archives, and then they'll republish them with their own ads, which strikes me as being kind of scummy. And probably not getting them a lot of money anymore, right? But okay. But in any case, you can find those things. And I wouldn't necessarily recommend you actually doing that search yourself, because all of my answers are from like 3 or 4 years ago, and they're about Xcode 3, so they're really only kind of historic use at best. Well, I think what happened was people complained about the fact that this great resource that they had was not available for NDA content.
Yeah.
And so Apple said, well, we've got to fix that. And of course, what they did to fix it was they made, you know, devforums.apple.com, which I think most of our listeners would know about already. And that did fix it, because then if the only way to get through the content was by signing in with your account, and they would know who you are, and they know whether you have access to that NDA content, then they can give you access to a forum where Apple folks can give you that same helpful information about the NDA content as they used to be able to give you about the regular content. Right? Good so far. But there's a bunch of problems with that approach then, because then the areas of the dev forums which are quote-unquote public in the sense that they're not NDA'd aren't searchable, at least that I've seen. I've never seen dev forums content.
There's parts of dev forums that you don't need an AEC account for?
Well, so that's actually the other thing, right? They make them all hidden behind this sign-in, even though they don't need to. I mean, it's the same information that you could get through a regular search, same information that's on Stack Overflow now. But yeah, they hide it, and then that means that it's just a lot harder to get. So, you know, the difference is I can search on Google, and then I got a lot of Stack Overflow links, or I can say, all right, I'm going to go to the dev forums, I'm going to log in. And of course, the logins don't ever really last very long, so you always need to log in again. And then you've got to go to search, and the search is kind of crappy. Or I could just use Stack Overflow. And so, you know, you wind up using Stack Overflow most of the time, because it's a lot faster, it's a lot simpler. So that's one problem.
And NDA information winds up there anyway. And that was kind of like one of the big, in the beginning of iOS, before the APIs were public, right? And even, I think even when they were like, when they did that stupid thing where like it still was under NDA, even though it wasn't, you know, it was.
Right.
There's that entire thing. I almost forgot all about this, but I saw that Big Nerd Ranch, did you see this, had that workaround? because he wanted to have the iOS programming course. And so the problem is that only you could discuss it with fellow employees.
Yeah.
And so what would happen is that Hillegas would employ all the students for a period of 1 week and would pay them $1 for one line of code.
Pay them
one,
yeah.
Yeah. So they were employees for that 1 week. And so that was that was a very, very clever little legal workaround. But I actually forgot how bad that was. And of course, with Stack Overflow, people were just talking regardless.
Well, from what I've seen, the ones that I saw, and I didn't search for them even back in the day. The ones I've seen since, when people talk about NDA and stuff, somebody usually comes up and says, you know, hey, no, you can't talk about that here. Now, so I think Stack Overflow is possibly better at self-policing than it used to be.
Oh, sure.
So, yeah. Well, what happens with those NDA discussions is that they never become un-NDA.
That is the big problem, yeah.
Right. And have you heard kind of the reason why, or the unofficial reason why, or the whispered reason why for that?
Well, I don't know if I have, but I would, if I were venture to guess, I imagine it's that would mean that after the veil is lifted, someone would need to go through all the postings and make sure that all that content is no longer should be classified. And that's a job that no one has, so it doesn't get done.
Yeah, so what I had heard, I don't remember where anymore, was that it was the same, like that sort of looser tongues kind of effect had even more of an effect in the NDA area, that people wound up saying things that, you know, that you would never want out of an NDA section, even though other things that they would say, many helpful things that they say, would become regular knowledge after that. So they just couldn't take the chance of releasing it in that way. Whereas if they had somehow been able to police their own employees better, such that you could be sure that everything they said would pass the smell test when it became public, then they could have gone ahead and done that. Although, of course, you know, there isn't anyone, I guess I don't know, but I would assume the way Apple works, that there isn't anyone monitoring every single thing you say in those forums. Because there certainly wasn't anyone doing that on the mailing list. That was pretty clear. Maybe there is. But I would think that the most they could do is spot check. So, in fact, you wouldn't be, if you could ensure that everybody had the right attitude going into it, you wouldn't be any less secure, I don't think, than otherwise. But anyway, it's not a not something I guess that we're going to make a lot of progress on here. But in any case, what I think overall is that they solved the NDA period issue. They made it so that you could get information during that period. But I think they basically threw away most of the other advantages of the mailing list by doing so. They made these forums virtually unusable in all the other cases. And now I've used them myself. I did post as an Apple employee a couple of times there. And I've posted as a employee since then asking questions. And I've gotten some answers on some things. But it's just not an integral part of my learning process.
Yeah, I actually realized I've totally forgotten about them. Like when I was looking for auto layout stuff lately, I didn't look at it one bit. I actually forgot I could do that.
Right, and that's the danger, right? Because I'm sure that there are at least some people on there who would be willing to take questions. I think there are some IB team people who you know, last time I checked, which was years ago, were on there. Although certainly they wouldn't, you know, the kind of things that you would say about auto layout, the kind of complaints you would make, obviously they wouldn't be able to answer any of those because they're not going to be able to say, oh yeah, we'll fix that next time around. You know, they can't say those sorts of things. So, but they might still be somewhat helpful. But now the reason you would want to learn technologies that early is, well, so that's kind of a special case, isn't it? Why would you want to do that? Well, you'd want to do that because you're going to ship something, you know, right when the OS gets released. Now, Wolf, have you done this on occasion?
Yeah, I believe I have for some clients.
Like, my impression is that that's actually fairly rare.
It is definitely not the majority of my work.
Right. And so one thing that's going to happen in that case is, you know, there aren't going to be any books available during that period. So even if you wanted to spend the money on a book and buy the book, you know, you're going to be out of luck in that case. And so, for example, what happened with me with Auto Layout was, you know, I waited till this book came out, But the book came out within the last, what, couple months? Mm-hmm. And, of course, Auto-A-Out has been out for, what, a year, 2 years now?
Yeah.
So if I wanted to earn it sooner than that, I would have had to rely on something other than books. So, you know, the WWDC sessions, Apple's pre-release documentation, and as you said, the NDA area of the forums. But that's kind of it. Of course, that's not nothing, right? That's good as far as it goes. But it can be, you know, it can not be enough in some cases. So really kind of all that's left is your own experimentation. And I think that's why we really prize people who take those steps, who try things out at the beginning and write blog posts about it or other things, and you become sort of the leaders of that sort of area. It occurs to me like Will Shipley learning SceneKit, for example, mm-hmm. although I'm not sure he's really written posts about it, which is a little unfortunate. Like, he's written other posts about interesting things, but he's never necessarily written about SceneKit. Hopefully with, what is it, Delicious Library 3 mm-hmm. out now, maybe he will he'll do a little bit more of that. And I think SceneKit is still new enough, although it isn't under NDA anymore, that something like that would still be very helpful to people, because I don't think there have been any books on it yet. I think it's just very new. Mm-hmm. But so as you said, it was rare. I think there was the one Michael Jurwitz post about, you know, how to be more successfully. Actually, not one post. He did a bunch of posts before, right before he went back to Apple. Mm-hmm. And I think at least one of them he mentioned. Maybe if he didn't mention it in the blog post, I did hear about him saying it in the sessions he gave. The session he gave at I'm blanking on it.
Singleton.
Okay, where he talked about this sort of thing, and one of the things he talked about was getting the most bang for your buck of working with Apple Technologies, because if you ship with the support for their newest technologies early enough, you're more likely to get mentioned or promoted by Apple. Right, so if you do Passkit, whatever it is, Passkit, right? Passport.
Yeah, I know.
Passkit. If you were to, you know, support that early on, maybe more likely that Apple would promote your application. And I think in sort of the App Store sales environment that there is now, where it's actually pretty difficult to get a lot of attention, that can really make the difference. So that would be one reason to go ahead and do it. Now, in my case, I have tended to work, so I don't generally do contract work. I've tended to work on large single applications for multiple years at a time. And the focus there is kind of the app itself, is adding new features to it, or, you know, evolving it in the way that it needs to go. And it's generally not, hey, let's add in, you know, new features, new Apple technologies right away. So the people I've known who tend to work with the newer technologies is often as contractors on small apps. And that's one of the plus sides of being a contractor that I think a lot of people really like, is you get exposed to a lot more stuff. You can put more stuff on your resume. You can just have a better sense of what's out there. But the downsides are, you know, the apps tend to be smaller and less ambitious overall. And of course, obviously, they're less under your control. And possibly there's sort of like death marches to get them done more. Because you're working for a client, you want to really get it done. Any of this ringing any bells? Well,
I would take some issues with some of this, but I'll let you fly.
Okay. All right. But the thing that we've seen recently, well, actually, one version we've seen recently, and we've also seen other versions of it recently, not recently, over the last couple of years, is that some high-profile Cocoa developers who are working on their own sort of larger apps or more involved apps, they eventually tend to give them up. And I think that's actually relatively new. I'm not sure I saw that sort of 10 years ago, but I've seen it, well, maybe it's been a while now. Like Brent Simmons did it with NetNewsWire.
Sure.
He, you know, gave up the whole thing. And Marco Arment did it more recently with Instapaper. Mm-hmm. And it always seems like a bit of a shock every time it happens, because, well, I guess obviously because they're not really talking about doing it before they do it.
Yeah. And you can understand why they couldn't.
Why they wouldn't. But you can kind of tell, because usually the app stops getting, you know, lots of updates. Mm-hmm. So, you know, maybe they get burnout or whatever. But, it means if you start a whole new app, you get to learn about a whole lot of new stuff.
Yeah.
With it. So. But one other area, so we talk about where you can learn stuff from. one of the ways that I think is actually maybe a little less useful than it used to be is just coworkers. Because if you're, you know, if you got somebody sitting right next to you, work with day in and day out, when you're learning something new, you can go over what you're learning with them. You can go over the problems that you're having, and you can figure things out more easily, faster. But I think that most people seem to focus on communicating through the internet nowadays, because, you know, they've got smaller companies, or you've got a lot of remote workers or remote contractors, that sort of thing. So there are a lot of people like that I really see, you know, asking these sorts of questions that I think otherwise you might ask, you know, the person sitting next to you, you know, they'll ask them on the internet. And when I was at Apple, the teams were small, but at least there were teams, right? You did have people who you were working with. However, you know, maybe you have sort of a whole team working on Interface Builder, for example, or a whole team working on Core Data. But the distinctive parts or features of that application or that functionality were handled just by one person. So this is actually a real-world example with Core Data. There was a whole team working on it, but there was just one person working on the modeling tool. Mm-hmm. So the person working on the modeling tool doesn't necessarily have a lot of people to talk to about modeling tool problems, because the rest of the team is working on, you know, sort of entities or APIs or whatever. So now I'm kind of making that last part up. I don't actually know what what went on in that person's head during that thing, but that's really a problem. And I actually saw this later on in Apple for myself, that I was on a team, but because I was working on something so specialized, that there actually wasn't anybody to talk to about it mm-hmm. when I was there. And that was unfortunate because, you know, you got this whole giant company with you, but you don't necessarily have anybody to talk to. And it's been my experience since then as well, that when the teams are really small, when the teams are working on when the people who work on the teams are working very different things, it can be problematic to get that kind of thing. And it's one thing that I miss. And again, maybe I'm just projecting on other things, but it does seem like it's harder to do these days because there are so many small teams and small projects. And I know, so you tend to work alone, Wolf.
Right.
Have you ever had that experience with sort of coworkers right next to you?
Oh, sure. I've done that too. But majority of my projects, I'm the lone wolf.
Yeah. I think I actually have to go back to my days at some of the internet companies I was at before Apple, to a point where I was sort of regularly discussing new technologies, new issues that I was facing with other people. So I just wanted to touch on that a little bit. But then, okay, so if you don't have the coworkers, then what I've seen, what gives me that impression that maybe people don't have the coworkers to turn to anymore, is that people tend to turn to technologies like Twitter.
Sure.
For their questions. Of course, Twitter has good sides and bad sides in terms of helping you with the learning process. I think it certainly you can know, quote unquote, be connected to a lot more people through Twitter than you could ever be in person. It's easy to broadcast queries is one thing that I've written down here. And it's also easy to have these informal conversations. Like if you had to write a blog post, if you had to write even a Stack Overflow question about stuff, that's really pretty high overhead.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. It can easily take an hour to do that versus, you know, Twitter being so terse. It forces you to, get to the point and also leave out a lot of stuff to people's imagination, which is usually good, but sometimes bad, obviously.
It can be bad if you try to get into a long conversation. And that's one thing, again, where I can really miss that about, you know, just talking to people in person. Because Twitter is a good way to start a conversation, but it's not a good way to have the whole conversation. Mm-hmm. But it's also a good way to have more people to reach out to.
Right.
I think let's see. You can find people. You can go talk with other people. You can go connect with them. Anyway, I think that's one thing that I've found. But so what I've done is I have tweeted about something, and then in order to actually give the full issue, I'll write a blog post, and then I'll tweet about it.
Right.
But I think blog posts are less important than they once were.
Right.
And my experience here is that I don't read them the same way that I used to. Because nowadays, still using RSS to read blog posts, but I'm not reading them on my computer anymore. I'm reading them, on my phone, as I go around. And if you're reading something, a tiny screen on the subway or whatever, that you can't give it the same attention that you would give it. So I know, is it Mike Ash who does the Friday?
Yeah, Q&A.
Q&A things?
Yeah.
They're very useful, but I'm finding when I'm reading them for the first time around, walking around or sitting on a subway, I can't give them the attention that they would need. I can't really learn from them directly. So what winds up happening is I have this sort of vague sense in my mind that I have, there was a post about X. And then I know, well, if I need to learn more about X, I'll go search on that post.
Mm-hmm.
So it is helpful. But it's very interesting how that usage has changed over time. And let's see. So the last thing I'm going to talk about in terms of resources is conferences themselves. Now I don't go to conferences very often. But I think other people might use conferences in the same way that they use Twitter, which is obviously for networking. For meeting the people who can help you. Now, obviously, they're not just meeting them so they can help you. It's social, whatever. But if you kind of factor out, well, how does that help them learn? I think it is having more people that you can reach out to about problems. And I think that's probably, if I were to go to more conferences, I think that would be what would make it worthwhile to me. Because I think in general, the kind of information that I've heard that you get at these conferences, the kind of sessions that you can go to, they've never really struck me in general as being enough to make it worthwhile to spend the money and the time to go to them. I guess it's mostly for me, that's because the conferences themselves can be expensive, relatively expensive. The airfare can be expensive. Taking the time off can be something that you can't do all the time. And so it's more that cost is higher than that the information is useless. It's just that the information isn't necessarily worth that cost for me when you can get so much of what you do through other means. And so that brings me back to WWDC.
Hey, so, I thought you said that we weren't going to talk about WWDC.
Well, I did. I said we were going to talk about it at the end.
Okay.
Okay. Just a little bit. WWDC is interesting in that it fits a bunch of the criteria of what I've talked about so far in terms of ways that you learn and ways you want to try to learn. So obviously you can get access to that NDA'd stuff right at the beginning if you go to WWDC. But one thing that I've said, I think I might have said it on the podcast before and I've said it on Twitter, is that it can be really hard, like trying to learn a new API by hearing somebody talk about it in a session is actually not all that helpful. Like, it's not really how, in my mind, it's not the best way to learn about technologies, about APIs. So really what you're getting from the sessions is just the announcement of the thing, I think, which again, you can't get anywhere else because Apple's announcing it for the very first time in this thing. So that can be useful. But again, if you're saying, well, I want to go to WWDC because I want to have the ability to learn stuff early, the trouble with that is, of course, you don't know what you're going to be learning, until after you've already gone, until after you've bought the ticket. So you kind of have to rely on rumors to be informed about whether it's a good investment to do that,
mm-hmm.
which I think is pretty bad. So again, I don't think that many people are going there specifically for that reason, although that's an advantage. If the other example is the labs. And there, you're hitting on a bunch of the categories that I mentioned, actually talking to another human being, talking to Apple employees about things, talking to them about details that you wouldn't learn any other way. But what I've found on the labs is that they're actually quite difficult to get that kind of benefit out of. If you miss, the person you might want to talk to you know, there might only be one person that you can talk to about things. And if you miss that person at a particular lab, then you're kind of out of luck. And if they're not right there, then you're kind of out of luck, or you have to, you know, follow through somehow. And if you're using older technologies, you're often out of luck because they don't want to talk about older technologies anymore. So what my impression here is if you're kind of a go-getter, if you're kind of a tinkerer, you can get a lot of that same information just by trying out the stuff yourself,
right,
and finding out what the workarounds are. If labs are your plan A, you should have a plan B, I think. So you know, you're given those two things, WWDC as a special conference, as a reason, okay, I should go there if I don't go to other conferences, it's kind of a crapshoot, I think. But of course, the other advantages that you get, you know, the socialization, the networking, that sort of thing, lots of people go.
You're leaving out the primary reason, which is Stump.
Yeah. I guess I am. I guess I am. Well, I'm not sure. Is that a learning experience?
Of course, maybe. It is. Absolutely. Every year.
Every year. Now, so you attend Stump then when you get a ticket?
Right.
Okay. I'll put that on the list then. Okay, so that's it for me. Did you have any
Yeah, you comments? Want to go back to how you don't finish books? Your dark secret?
yes. Yeah, good point. Well, what I found is the kind of books that I've gotten previously are sort of introductory, you know, large topic introductory books. I've gotten books on OS X to get started on that. I got a book on iOS to get started on that. And those books have kind of an impossible task to begin with, right? They want to introduce you to the big ideas, get you started on some simple sample applications. And then usually what happens is they kind of go off a bit into individual topics. So the iOS book I have talked about Core Data and talked about SQLite and talked about a couple of other things. And there's this, you know, at some point I was just like, well, you know, to get going with the application that I'm working on right now, I don't need to read all the rest of this stuff. Mm-hmm. I've kind of gotten the starter, gotten the boost to get going. And so I'm only going to come back to those things when I need to learn those individual things. Of course, the trouble is then, you know, a year or two go by before I necessarily need to go back to some of these chapters. And by then, the book is kind of out of date. Mm-hmm. So really, you know, when I do buy books, I should really do more of that thing where I read everything to start off with, because they really do have a bit of a shelf life to do that. And so I think that's the reason why there are a lot of books that I haven't finished, because I do tend to use books as a boost rather than as a buffet, I guess. Tim makes metaphors. I don't eat the whole thing, you know? And maybe I should. I don't know.
Based on how you're describing how you use it, which I'm very similar, I think your strategy is correct. It doesn't feel good, but you said that information is obsolete, and yet you would spend the hour and change or what have you reading this technology that you don't end up using, and then time moves on, and you can get newer information.
Right. And it wouldn't just be an hour. You know, when I read these books in order to really get the information through, you know, I'll take time to do the sample applications.
Oh, wow, you actually do the sample application. Okay.
Sometimes. And, you know, so that's like, you know, it's days. It's days of you know, on and off work to get through a book. And, yeah, it's, you know, you wouldn't think that that's a lot of a commitment. But these days, it turns out it is.
Yeah. Short attention span programming.
I'm sorry, what were you saying?
Short attention. Oh, you got me.
So anything else?
The one other thing you mentioned is that the kind of like having the need to ship something or to really learn it.
Yep.
I think the same thing about like I know I keep on bringing it up, but the semantic versioning stuff, and you don't call it a 1.0 in your little semantic versioning until you use it in a commercial product, or not a commercial product, and it practically actually, you know, really the definition is a little bit finer point than that. It's just like basic guarantee that the API is usable and it won't change in a breaking way at that point. But practically, you want to wait until it's actually being used in production. At that point, even if you feel like it still feels like a 0.3 to you, I mean, if you are using it in production, that means it has a lot of value and you should share it. And you should call it a 1.0.
Right. And it is interesting that there were times when I was looking through this topic when I was kind of talking about learning things and building things as if they were the same topic, because in a lot of ways they are.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's true, and I think it's good to think about, you know, versioning that way. Yeah, and is this part of something larger? This sort of you said like a versioning philosophy.
Yeah, this is the semantic versioning stuff.
Semantic versioning. Oh, that's right. Yeah. And you had mentioned that. All right, so we'll put the link on that in this episode as well, because I believe we put it in a previous one.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, cool. So please visit our website, edgecasesshow.com, all one word. First show notes, a link to our podcast on iTunes, and more. And you can find us individually on Twitter, me, A. Pontius. Should I really need to spell this stuff every time?
You know, if we had an outro, you guys could check out already.
Maybe a song. you know what? Just click on the website. We're good. All right. See you next time.